Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino, with Michael Von Cannon producing. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Our scene today is Madrid, 1936. We are talking about the Spanish Civil War, Hemingway, Martha Gellhorn, John Dos Passos, and a lesser-known figure named José Robles. We will discuss who this man was and how his unhappy fate caused Hemingway and Dos Passos' friendship to reach the breaking point. To discuss all the moving parts of this episode in Hemingway's life, we turn to Stephen Koch, author of, appropriately, The Breaking Point, Hemingway, Dos Passos, and the Murder of José Robles. Koch is a prolific author about art, history, and literature. He's written about Andy Warhol, Robert Mapplethorpe, and he serves as the executor for the artist Peter Hujar's estate. We are so delighted that he could join us today. Stephen Koch, welcome to One True Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on, and we're delighted to talk about your book, The Breaking Point, Hemingway, Dos Passos, and the Murder of José Robles. And we've had a show, Stephen, talking about Hemingway's relationship with Dos Passos, but we haven't really focused on this particular episode of his life with José Robles. So can you give us the broad strokes of what this episode was and the significance of it?
Sure. I hope I can do it quickly. It's a little complicated. José Robles was a very, very smart and very well-educated Spaniard from an aristocratic conservative family who turned left in his youth and had big arguments with his family. And so he moved to America, where he became a professor of Spanish at Johns Hopkins University. He always wanted to see a revolution in Spain. And when the Spanish Civil War started up, he went to Spain and volunteered his services to the Spanish government. He was very useful because he was multilingual. He spoke perfect English, Spanish, and Russian, and a couple of other languages as well. In that job, he became the right hand, the Spanish right hand, of the most important Soviet general sent by Stalin into the Spanish Civil War. That's his big position. His little position is that he had been, since graduate school, a close friend of John Dos Passos. At the same time that John Dos Passos was a very close friend of Hemingway's. Mm. And as a matter of fact, he'd even translated two of Dos Passos's books into Spanish. They were very close, remained always very close. But this happened to interrupt the situation. At some point, probably because Stalin had decided to, as they say, liquidate General Góra once he was through giving his services in Spain, for some reason that has never been established, a extra-legal, probably squad of NKVD agents came to Robles' house, arrested him, and a few days later blew out his brains in a basement. At this point, Hemingway and Dos Passos were both coming to be American correspondents in the Spanish Civil War. First thing that Dos Passos wanted to do was connect with his old buddy, and discovered that his old buddy had mysteriously disappeared without a trace. Hemingway arrived with his new girlfriend, Martha Gellhorn, and the tensions between the two of them grew steadily all the time they were in Spain. Dos Passos set out, understandably, to get to the bottom of his friend's disappearance, quite unaware that this was politically highly sensitive. Hemingway thought, what is he doing? He's messing up my whole time in Spain by getting everybody irritated and upset about us. Martha Gellhorn once said to him when he first arrived in, they first met in Spain, you're making very embarrassing situations for us. Us meaning Ernest and herself. So it took a while for Dos Passos to get clarity on the fact that his friend had been murdered. That was the breaking point between him and Hemingway.
In the tension that emerges between Hemingway and Dos Passos, looking back at this scene 80 or 90 years later, are we saying that Hemingway was cynical and self-serving? Are we saying that Dos Passos was naive and idealistic? Is it clear who was right?
I wouldn't say that it's absolutely clear-cut. You can say that the episode in Spain, which Hemingway later came to regret, he would speak of my bad period in Spain. Hemingway was in many ways at his worst. He'd had bad trouble writing his last book, and he was unsure. His marriage was breaking up. He was in a relationship with a complex relationship with a new woman. Dos Passos was naive in a way, and he responded to the political situation, I would say, in a naive and idealistic way. But he was persistent and he was not dumb. He got to the bottom of the story. And that is what Hemingway found intolerable.
One of the things that emerges from your book, Stephen, is that Dos Passos and Hemingway, first of all, were temperamentally different.
Very.
Second of all, their backgrounds were different. So even if, and perhaps even their sympathies, while it might have seemed superficially aligned, they were quite different people in Spain in 1937, weren't
Absolutely.
They?
Absolutely. First of all, their backgrounds were dramatically different. We could go into that. But the first thing I would say is, up until Spain, Hemingway had never exhibited the tiniest interest in the actual political workings of the Spanish government. When it came to the Roosevelt administration, up until he got to Spain, he'd been rather on the conservative side. He thought there was a lot of reckless spending for on a lot of no good people taking money from good people. He was not a political man. He didn't have a political mind. Dos Passos was passionately interested in politics, deeply interested. I would say almost too interested in it. He understood situations much better than Hemingway ever came to understand them. And they were also temperamentally very different. Hemingway had come from an upper middle class Midwestern family, a sort of classic family, whereas Dos Passos had a kind of Henry Jamesian story behind him. He was the illegitimate son of a very cultivated woman and a very, very rich American man. He had been raised in Europe with his mother taking him from spa to spa and one place to another, learning languages while he went, but an unacknowledged son of a very rich man, Randolph Dos Passos. There was a very big difference in the way they came to things.
I wanted to point out, we had James McGrath Morris on our program that discussed Hemingway and Dos Passos both as ambulance drivers in World War I in Italy.
Which is where they met.
They shared an experience, yet Dos Passos is coming from Harvard and Hemingway is coming as a teenager right off the streets of Oak Park. Right. So they had different worldviews.
Hemingway never passed up a chance to be snotty about Harvard. Love insulting the institution. Yes, they were very different. Dos Passos was conventionally very well educated, and he was also in a sort of upper class. For example, when he was in Spain, first in Spain as a young man, he was expected to get into a tuxedo and a wing collar and go to dinner with the American ambassador to Spain because of his connections. which he complained about, but he did it. So, yes, they were very different people. There's an anecdote that will really illustrate this, and it's found in Das Passa's book, his autobiographical book. I'm forgetting the title, but nonetheless, it starts with an anecdote that is the exact reverse of what Hemingway would have done. He said, one night after I began to publish, I was in a dinner at Ratner's restaurant in New York, and I noticed that there was a teenage boy a couple of tables away who kept looking at me and looking at me and looking at me, and I wondered why. When the end of the meal came, the kid came up to him and said, "Are you John Dos Passos?" He said, "Yes." "Are you really John Dos Passos?" "Yes." "Well, I just got to say one thing. You sure are a disappointment."
Wow. Now,
that's the way he began his autobiography. Can you imagine Hemingway doing the same thing?
Not at all.
Hemingway was never a disappointment to anybody, no matter what.
And we are coming in 1937 where, as you point out in your book, Dos Passos had his face on Time magazine.
Correct.
So we might look at these two writers differently all these years later, but at the time, Dos Passos being in Spain was as big a deal as Hemingway being in Spain, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it was also, look at the moment in Hemingway's life. He'd just done what many people think of as one of his worst books. Had a terrible time with it. In addition to which, it was filled with libelous statements about a character based on Dos Passos. And Scribner's lawyers had said to him, "It's got to go. We just are not going to publish this." He tore it all out resentfully, but he was in a very uncertain moment in his writing career. And suddenly here was his old buddy, John Dos Passos, getting to be world famous. So his competitive instincts were really touched in a very vulnerable place.
Stephen, maybe you can walk us through what you were starting to say earlier about Dos Passos and Robles. So if they had a relationship that predated the Civil War,
right?
When did that start? And are you suggesting that there were parts of Robles's work and his network of relationships that even Dos Passos was unaware of?
Oh, absolutely. Dos Passos, when he went to Spain, went as a complete naive, saying, "The Spanish people and the people who support change in Spain are fighting back, and they're going to get their rights away from a conservative monarchist government." He did not understand that Stalin had understood the adventure in Spain as being of particular interest to him and had intervened with the idea of taking it over. Robles, on the other hand, was much more sophisticated than Dos Passos politically. He knew that when he was working as an adjutant to a major Soviet general, he was involved in the Soviet engagement in the whole war. Hemingway had no idea about this. So when he came, he was with Martha Gellhorn, who was, by the way, also much more sophisticated about politics than Hemingway, much more so. So neither of them really understood, until the Robles affair, the degree of Soviet involvement in the events taking place in Spain and the negative effects of some of that involvement. By the time Hemingway wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls, he had begun to wise up. It's important to remember that For Whom the Bell Tolls is a book that Hemingway began to write the day that the Spanish Republic fell. Not the day after and not the day before. That day he began to write it. Many of my critics have complained that I overvalue For Whom the Bell Tolls. And it is quite common in sort of highbrow circles to patronize the book a little bit. I don't agree. I don't think it's a perfect novel, but very few novels are perfect. I think it's a very powerful and impressive novel. If you compare it to a novel that gets a lot of respect, deservedly gets a lot of respect, like The Sun Also Rises, it's much more complex and intellectually ambitious. Much and successfully. And it's Soviet character, the Soviet underground operative, Koltsov, who was presented in that book, is presented with quite a high degree of sophistication and accuracy.
You're mentioning about the importance of For Whom the Bell Tolls and the greatness of For Whom the Bell Tolls. Is there something about Hemingway's politics that you observe about For Whom the Bell Tolls? Do you consider that a balanced presentation where he's looking at a multiplicity of perspectives?
No, I don't think anyone should go to For Whom the Bell Tolls for a really balanced and insightful assessment of the Spanish Civil War. I think it is a brilliant personal assessment of it. And I think that it is filled with tremendous power as literature. And I think that it is reasonably insightful about the war. But if you compare him to, say, Arturo Barea or Burnett Bulletin or other nonfiction writers about the Spanish Civil War, it's kind of deficient. I don't care about that because I don't care. When I read A Farewell to Arms, I don't go to my history books to see whether this is exactly right. You know, this is fiction and it deserves the respect of fiction.
On the other hand, you talk quite a lot in your book about the Spanish Earth, which is sort of unapologetic propaganda for the cause. But there seems to be – so the character that I think we should introduce at this point is Joris Evans. So who is this guy and how does he play into this triangle between Dos Passos and Hemingway?
Joris Evans was a very talented documentary filmmaker and a communist who became an agent of the Communist International. He worked with them and for them. This was covert, but nonetheless, that's how it worked. He was put in charge of making a documentary film. And in order to do that, he'd been living in New York, was a very sort of chic. He and his wife were sort of chic figures in the village scene of the time. And he created an organization called Contemporary Historians, which was essentially a cover operation, which would have various distinguished names in front of it, hiding the fact that it was a pure propaganda film. One of the contemporary historians was Dos Passos, another was Hemingway. And the film was eventually released as a film somehow by Ernest Hemingway. This is entirely wrong. It is by Joris Evans. Hemingway was consulted here and there, maybe a little bit, and came to a few of the sites where things were going on and was the voiceover. In the Princeton Library, there's a large correspondence between Hemingway and Martha Gellhorn. When she went to New York to do the finishing work with Evans, finishing work on the Spanish Earth, and the letters, I hesitated to even quote them, but I can say it now, are filled with gleeful accounts of how they managed to ice the contribution of John Dos Passos out of the project so that he would never be mentioned, and he never is. But in a long historical view, The Spanish Earth is a film by Joris Evans, who was advised here and there by Hemingway and used his voice for propaganda reasons as the voiceover.
So Hemingway emerges from this episode as kind of a useful idiot, as somebody that they can, whose name they can exploit for their own cause.
Absolutely. When I first started exploring this branch of the world, this neck of the woods, one of my first interviews was with the widow of a minor writer named Gustav Regler.
Yeah.
Who had been on the scene at the time and was friendly with all these people. She told me, and he was a very active communist in the Comintern, Communist International, and she told me that the obsession with reeling in Hemingway and getting him on board their deal was crazy. It just was obsessional. There was a huge focus on it among advisors, including the more senior advisors, from the Soviets to the Spanish government. He was the big Marlin they wanted to reel in.
And Hemingway was unaware of this. You don't think in his late 30s he would have been sensitive to this kind of outreach?
I think in his late 30s, Hemingway had become used to assuming that wherever he went, he would be treated as a very famous and important man. Mm. And so he was being treated as a very important and famous man. And he said, well, that's the way it goes. That's who I am. He wasn't surprised that major political figures and major generals and major communist insiders. Koltsov made daily reports to Stalin by telephone. Daily. I mean, we're talking about really as high as you can get in that particular political system. And Hemingway didn't necessarily know that, but he knew he was a big deal. But then Hemingway thought, why not? I'm a big deal too.
Right.
I know they're using me. But I'm convinced, because Martha Gellhorn tells me I should be convinced, that this is a wonderful project. And in many ways, the Spanish Civil War was a wonderful project. It was a very important but doomed effort on the part of many good people to create reform in Spain.
This episode of One True Podcast is supported by the Hemingway Review, the scholarly journal of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and Society. Michael and I are excited about the fall 2023 issue with guest editors Ian Marshall and Margaret E. Wright Cleveland, where their theme for this issue is Hemingway in Black and White. It's a fascinating collection of voices tackling a wide range of issues related to Hemingway and race. For this special issue and back issues, please visit HemingwaySociety.org/journals. This episode is brought to you by the Left Bank Writers Retreat. Our friend Darla Warden is leading an amazing literary retreat to the cafes, parks, and museums of Paris. Through walking tours and small group workshops, participants will discover more about Hemingway's Paris and their own. This year, the Left Bank Writers Retreat will take place from August 31st to September 6th, 2024, and is limited to just 8 writers. So act fast. Visit leftbankwriters.com for more information about the details of this unique experience and how to register for it. leftbankwriters.com. Do you think that even though Martha Gellhorn was more sophisticated than Hemingway politically, that looking back on all the events and the web of relations, even she was naive about some of the roots of the activity?
The psychology of Martha Gellhorn is a real poser. It's not easy to figure out. To work closely with her story, to know her that way is not to love her. She was highly opportunistic. She set out to, A, destroy Hemingway's marriage and become his wife, though she complained about it for decades afterwards. Nonetheless, it was a very important career move for her. And how clearly she saw the cynicism of the Soviet advisors working in Spain is not clear. She remained passionately against all criticism of the way the Soviets behaved in Spain until the day she died. She loathed and frequently attacked George Orwell for writing Homage to Catalonia because it cast aspersions on the Soviet operations. By the way, it should be said that when I interviewed Ivins in Paris, he was an old man, but jolly and pleasant and interesting. He referred to the Robles affair in the most interesting way. He said, Robles was a fascist spy. He was sending signals across the lines by mirrors and lights to the enemy. He deserved to die.
Wow.
Now, that was the line, the common term line on him. Nobody believes that. Nobody believes that anymore, except maybe, I mean, Ivins did until the day he died, or claimed to believe it. What Martha thought about the situation was, Dos Passos meddling with the Spanish government and the apparatus that had brought them there in order to be American correspondents in the war was messing things up from her point of view. That's what she was really annoyed by. She was making it difficult for them to solidify their relations with the powers that be.
Stephen, I just want to follow up for 1 second on your interview with Ivins towards the end of his life. Did he express any remorse about any of his own actions, or his own involvement? Did he look back with guilt, or was he proud of his activities?
He was very proud of his activities. He was especially proud, I would say. Okay, he was boastful about his relationship with Hemingway. He did a lot of talk about Hemingway and what great buddies they had been and how they went through so much together and what a great man he was. That filled up most of the interview.
Wow. You mentioned Orwell, and I love when Orwell appears in your book because he's almost a breath of fresh air. He seems to be a completely different perspective on the war.
Yes, it is a complete perspective because, first of all, Orwell had not come to Spain as a big deal. The Spanish government didn't care who he was, whereas the Spanish government met Hemingway and Dos Passos right away and started to manipulate them as hard as they could possibly manipulate. Orwell was a guy in the trenches, and he started putting two and two together. And the chance of Dos Passos bumping into Orwell is a fluke. Why? Because Orwell, in addition to being a guy in the trenches, was a very literary guy who was excited. Oh, my God, I'm in the same hotel with John Dos Passos. I would love to talk to him. And so they had a brief interview together.
So the Hotel Florida, it seems like a kind of a raucous, chaotic affair where you have all of these luminaries, journalists, celebrities, and they're in the middle of a war zone.
Right. This is something that you have to start learning about. I don't know that it's going on right now. We've got two horrible wars going on. Mm. But the participants in this war, including the Spaniards, the legitimately revolutionary Spaniards, and those compromised by the Soviets, wanted a big propaganda apparatus around them of people who were on their side and whose names got in the newspapers as soon as every time they could arrange it. That was the Hotel Florida. It was the celebrity wasp's nest. Huh. All around its atrium were lined up people who were part of the propaganda arrangement. Not military people, not revolutionaries, not the Russians, and not the Spanish government, but people who were there to promote the Spanish left. I mean, one of them was Antoine Saint-Exupéry, the author of Le Petit Prince. Hemingway was there. Dos Passos was there. Room by room, they were various useful celebrities. Useful idiots is a rough way of referring to it, because the last thing I would ever call Hemingway was an idiot. He was certainly not that. But he was, at that moment, tremendously emotionally under the influence of the opportunity to change his life, change the woman in his life, change his literary life, and change his reputation through Spain.
Tell me about the title of your book, The Breaking Point. Why is that an appropriate phrase?
Well, first of all, it was the breaking point between Hemingway and his friendship with Dos Passos. I mean, it's worth remembering here, not only were they good friends, but in the early stages, at the time that, say, Manhattan Transfer or The Big Money was being written, Hemingway really thought that Dos Passos was one of the very great writers alive. He believed it. He was very interested in fixing up Dos Passos before he got married to Katie Dos Passos with his sister Ursula. He thought he'd be a wonderful brother-in-law. So, I mean, that's the kind of intimacy that we're talking about. And Dos Passos, of course, did not marry Ursula, but it was a rupture of a friendship that was not casual. It was essential. They had been together from day one. They had made their careers together. They admired each other endlessly.
So is the rupture, though, about a political difference over Spain, or is it specifically about the Robles affair?
I think the Robles affair was the trigger that ignited the big difference. And I think there's a tragedy involved here. Before I go on, I just want to mention one thing that I got interviewing Dos Passos' daughter. She told me that she used to reprimand her father for being so passive and okay about Hemingway's cruelties and nastiness to him. How can you stay friends with this man who said what he said about you? And she said his answer was, you must understand, he's not mentally normal. Yeah. He can't help it.
In the sense that he's a bully or he's insecure?
Both. It's amazing the range of Hemingway's personality. You can go from the extraordinary, insightful, very decent, very gentlemanly man who did the Paris Review interview with George Clinton, an amazing document. I mean, I read it when I was a teenager. I thought, this is the greatest man I ever heard of. It's wonderful. And then someone who was in his personal behavior, I think that he was unquestionably bipolar, as was Robert Lowell and Van Gogh and Virginia Woolf. I think that he had a serious psychiatric illness. He was an alcoholic. And when he spun out of control, he really spun out of control.
Yeah, his history of friendships that turn into rivalries or vicious tension, it's really extraordinary if you start listing all of the friendships that have gone wrong.
Correct. It's tragic and it's sad because this is not just one notable author being rivalrous with another notable author. There's a crazy side to it. Yep. There's an anecdote, whether it's true or not, you would know, that when he started to be aware of Faulkner's stature, he once sat up all night with a gun in his lap, waiting to shoot Faulkner in case he walked in the door. Now, this is insane.
Yeah.
It was really insane.
Oh, if we talk about the breaking point, is there a moment that is the literal breaking point?
Yes, there is. There was a meeting exactly when Dos Passos came to realize that Robles was dead and had been shot, killed, murdered. Is not exactly clear, but it was around the time that a huge fiesta was being held to entertain visiting celebrities in Spain, put on by the Spanish government. And all kinds of very notable people were there. It was celebrity heaven. It was this occasion that Hemingway took this occasion to come up to Dos Passos in public and tell him what a fool he had been. His friend had been found out to be a fascist spy and had been shot. it was set up to humiliate and embarrass and discredit this process in the most public possible way. And that's what happened. That was where things broke. By the way, Dos Passos never stopped caring for Hemingway. They did sort of patch things up in later years. I don't think they ever returned to their old intimacy, but they did sort of patch things up. There's another breaking point that I think is worth mentioning. It's a little painful, but true. Hemingway came out of this experience writing a very good, arguably great, but very good novel about the Spanish Civil War. Dos Passos came out with his talent broken and destroyed. He never again wrote a book of much interest. He lived for a long time, steadily drifting, like many idealists of the left, when they become disillusioned, of the hard left, drift steadily toward idealists of the hard right. It's a familiar form of intellectual degeneration, I would say. I'm not saying there were certain times, a book called The Best Times by Dos Passos is a pretty good book, but his gift as one of the great American modernists was shattered and never came back.
So when they did patch up their relationship, did they hash this episode out, or did they move beyond it?
I do not know how much they said to each other. Mm. It became a public matter when the next Dos Passos novel came out, which was not a very good novel, and which was panned, especially in the New Republic magazine, but by Malcolm Cowley, then one of the most eminent critics, but in his Salinist phase. And he attacked Dos Passos politically, as politically naive and reprehensible and unenthusiastic about things like Stalin's purge trials that you were supposed to think were wonderful. And Dos Passos wrote a letter, which is one of the important documents in the case, explaining what had happened. Very reasoned, very rational, very not in any way personally accusing Hemingway at all. Hemingway's name is not used at all. And it is an important document, quite eloquent document in the history of the Robles affair. So Hemingway knew that this was not just a personal issue between him and the Passos.
And you include that in your book.
I include the letter in my book.
That eloquent letter that Dos Passos writes to the New Republic.
Correct.
The point that you make in great detail in The Breaking Point is when Hemingway does break the news about Robles to Dos Passos, he does it in an orchestrated way, but almost a sadistic way. That he's enjoying seeing the pain in Dos Passos' face. So it's a really unseemly episode.
It's very unseemly. It is just obviously reprehensible.
Yeah.
That a lifelong friend of yours, discovering something that he thinks is deeply embarrassing to you, should be broken in front of a big crowd of people at a party, instead of walking down the hall in the hotel, knocking on the door and saying, I've got some bad news.
There are a couple of lesser known Hemingway works that you mention in your book that I was really interested in how you see them fitting into the overall puzzle of Hemingway and Spain. And I really enjoyed being reminded of these texts, and I'm hoping you can talk about them just for a minute or so. And one is Treachery in Aragon, and the other is Old Man at the Bridge. So can you remind us what those pieces are and why they are significant?
They're both very short, but they're signposts of the extremes that were going on. Treachery in Aragon was a piece that Hemingway wrote for a short-lived sort of chic magazine called Ken, men's magazine called Ken. And it was not using Dos Passos' name, a virulent attack on Dos Passos and everything that had gone on, really accusing Vespasius of being a traitor to the cause. Hemingway later did everything he could to suppress this grotesquerie, so successfully that it took me months and months to track down a copy of it anywhere. Finally, I found it in the University of Delaware special collections, a couple that had collected Hemingway memorabilia, donated it to the university, into the Delaware special collections, and they found a copy of it, which was sent to me by a very considerate young librarian. That's the only way I ever would have found it. Now, the other story is something very different. It's very short, like Treachery in Aragon. It is a description of one of the people whose lives has been torn up by the war. And he's an old man, and he's exhausted, and he speaks about what has happened to his life and how it's been destroyed. And I would not say it was one of the great Hemingway stories, but it is in the line with the great Hemingway stories. It's moving. It's powerful. It is not propagandistic. And it is like his first step back into his true personality.
Yeah, and nobody reads that story. It's such an obscure work.
It's a very obscure work. In many ways, it deserves to be an obscure work, except I think it's important in the biography.
Right.
I think it was when he remembered for a while who he was.
Stephen, I don't want to end this interview without asking you, just given your career and the interests that you've accrued over your life, where does this fit in? How did you come to Hemingway and Dos Passos and decide to write about it?
When I was very young, around the age of 11, I decided I was born to be a writer. At that time, I had a newspaper route, and it was in Northfield, Minnesota, where Carleton College is located. And one of the places where I delivered the Minneapolis Tribune every morning was to the bookstore in Carleton College. So I would go into the bookstore. One of the manager's daughters was a very, very early juvenile girlfriend of mine. But they had stuff laid out. And with my money from the paper route that I had, I bought my first hardcover book and my first literary magazine. Mm-hmm. And the first hardcover book was The Selected Writings of Gertrude Stein, which I thought looked very fancy and high-toned. And the other was The Paris Review with the Hemingway interview. And believe me, I was blown away by that. I still regard it as one of the turning points of my life and one of the great documents in a great literary career. It's a very impressive piece of work. I've reread it many times. I know lines of it by heart.
Yeah.
And it was Hemingway at his best.
Very generous responses to those questions.
Very generous, very intelligent, very receptive, not confrontational, decent in every way, and thoughtful and right. And this was done, I would like to know how and when, in the middle of a period when Hemingway was going through cyclical degeneration. Yeah. And psychiatric collapse, so that to the degree that Mary Hemingway was virtually a psychiatric nurse.
This would have been 1958 when that article came out.
That's right. 1958. He was very near the end. But it was an amazing performance.
Okay, so how does that lead to this story?
I always was interested in Hemingway. I had ups and downs, like many people. I think things were wonderful. When I came to write the story of his relation with Dos Passos and over the Robles affair, I dove back into Hemingway and revised many of my long-term judgments, which I would say were immature, at least. Hemingway, the macho bully, Hemingway, the braggadocio, and so forth, had affected me also a very widespread, somewhat highbrow opinion that Hemingway was a great writer as a young man, but that in his later life, he was not a great writer. I revised strongly. I think he was a great writer as a young man. I also think that in his middle phase, a story like The Snows of Kilimanjaro is one of the greatest pieces of writing about marriage ever written. Yeah. It's just amazingly good. At the same time, the book, The Short Happy Life of Francis Bacabre, I don't take seriously. And in addition to which, I will still stick by my view against other opinion that For Whom the Bell Tolls is an important and wonderful book. Maybe not great, but very, very good.
Well, the flip side to this is that, you know, not too many people are kicking back and reading the USA trilogy in 2024, even though at the time it was viewed as this colossus of American literature.
I would say the further back you go in Dos Passos, the better the work gets. Yeah. Manhattan Transfer is a great book, but it's true, it's not read by many people. And it's not promoted as a great book. It's not in classes. It's not being, it's not in the syllabus of everybody's modern literature course. But it's a wonderful piece of work and was recognized as such at the time. I have theories about what happened with Dos Passos. One is that he became a little too interested in politics. His great inspiration was the modernist movement of the very early 20th century. Yep. That was what changed everything for him. From Stravinsky to T.S. Eliot. Yeah. And that was an inspiration that carried him a long way. As he moved away from that, deeper into politics, the work suffered a bit. In the mid-1930s, Stalin's main man in cultural matters made a speech in front of an important communist assembly, including the Communist International, in which he said, in the democracies and in the capitalist world of decadence, a kind of art has developed that is decadent and destructive and must be opposed. We are going to replace it with socialist realism. That was the first time that doctrine was laid down. And he said, who are the best examples of this decadent art? And he said, there are two. If you're wondering what it is, look at James Joyce and John Dos Passos. They must be eliminated. So from the Stalinist point of view, the Comintern point of view, by the time he got to Spain and was talking to Joris Ivens, a Comintern agent, he was dead meat. Hemingway, later, even before the problem with came up with Robles, Hemingway was withdrawing some of his enthusiasm for Dos Passos' work. He said, when I read a book, I like it to have it take me from one place to another. And he felt that scattershot way yeah. that Dos Passos wrote was ineffective.
The book is The Breaking Point, Hemingway, Dos Passos, and the Murder of Jose Robles. Stephen Koch, thank you so much for joining us on One True Podcast. It's been a pleasure.
It's been very enjoyable. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. Thank you.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode and past episodes are available on onetruepod.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Our book, One True Sentence, Writers and Readers on Hemingway's Art, is available anywhere books are sold. So if you have someone in your life who loves books and Hemingway, buy a copy or two and spread the joy. You can also support this podcast by leaving us a rating and telling your friends all about us. Feel free to write us at onetruepod@gmail.com. That's the number one. truepod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. This show is supported by the Hemingway Society and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast.